John Gatto, it's wonderful to be with you this afternoon.
It's great to be back in the Valley again, Dale. Thanks for having me on. And I'm certainly as militantly hostile to public schooling as anybody in the world, including, I think I'm tied with Brigham Young from out your way, who wrote scathing editorials and essays against Utah ever taking on the government schooling yoke. And the irony, of course, is that Utah is now at the very top of the heap. We're playing ball with Washington.
Indeed. I thought, in considering how I would introduce you today, John, I thought about talking a little bit about the Bolsheviks, not that you have anything in common with them, but, you know, when the Bolsheviks finally got a hold of Russia, they took Christian churches, and rather than bulldoze them, sort of decently, just bulldoze them out of existence, they turned them into, what will we say, stables and public lavatories. And I guess that's the only limiting description I can think of for my feelings towards the public school, is that I at least would not, render them into some sort of foul mechanism like that. I would at least bulldoze them. So there is some limit to my contempt, but it's a very upper limit. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I have some association with a first-class public school. I think it's in Utah. It's Pam Lockwood's High School of the Performing Arts. Just a beautiful place, because at least for a while she was allowed to bring her art as a performing artist to touch the lives of kids, and it was wonderful to see. I don't know if it's still in existence, but I hope it is. But it is an irony, isn't it, Dale, that Brigham Young was so adamantly opposed, and Utah is one of three or four states that are the prize of the federal ed department in Washington because they're so neat and orderly and follow the rules of public schooling, which are basically, and this is going to sound very radical, but I intend to prove it to you, which are intended to fill the minds of the young with half-truths and nonsense. The major architects of public schooling aren't Horace Mann, who was a politician and a prevaricator of major league proportions. He's the one who brought German schooling into the United States, and anyone in the Valley can go to the public library. Horace Mann's letters to the Boston school community will be available in any good library in Utah. Read his seventh letter to the Boston school community. It's the most famous of his essays. And he's begging that Prussian schooling be brought to the United States. And in short order, it was brought to the United States. Prussian schooling set out deliberately to confuse the mass of people, the ordinary minds, with half-truths. It actually existed to teach obedience. And the only way you know whether people are obedient is if they'll follow stupid orders. Now, I think that in itself is a kind of weird logic, and it's obviously psychologically true. You can't know whether your students have been broken to the memory game unless they will do stupid things. So you ask them to do stupid. I'm not indicting school teachers in this. They're just employees. I'm not even indicting principals or even superintendents. They're all relays on a system that we don't bother to ask anymore where it comes from and what its purposes are. It's really spooky.
Well, that's about as good a metaphor as I've ever heard, John, is this word relay. And it's a little bit, I guess it's a little bit like somebody who's involved with some kind of authoritarian religion. Their fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers were immersed in this. And they just don't consider they don't go back and do research. It's just sort of part of the landscape. But as I think back, you know, I'm almost 50, and I get more nuanced in my recollection and my reflections about the public school period, the 12 years I went through, and how it shaped my life so determinatively. The thing that's really hitting me hard right between the eyes as we talk right now is that we had the Enlightenment in Europe, and then we had the Enlightenment expressed, actualized in our revolution over here in the United States and in America. And the synthesis of that whole process was the individual man as the sovereign. And it was just a radical idea that we could be almost a nation of kings if we were willing to take on that that mantle. And this thing that you're talking about is a system specifically, I mean, athwart that, directly athwart that, that it is meant to negate that concept specifically and in detail and guarantee a large fraction of the population will be servants, will have the minds of servants.
Well, you know, it's very subtle, though, Dale. The idea that you just laid before your listeners, the Enlightenment ideal, still exists, and it exists among the people who gave us public schooling. But here's what happened between the growth of that ideal and today. Major thinkers intervened and said that for most people, not all, but that for most people, it was hopeless to think of anything as fanciful as education because they were born dumb and dangerous, and they were going to stay dumb and dangerous. Let me give you a couple of the big names so this isn't just some abstraction. If we can start a number of places, but let's start with the great liberal philosopher, Benedict Spinoza. I know he's called Baruch, but he never called himself Baruch. So he's Benedict Spinoza, huge influence on colonial America. Spinoza said in a book that will be available in the university libraries out that way, Tractatus Religico Politicus, published in 1690, that almost everybody, but not everybody, but almost everybody, was permanently irrational and murderously so. So he advised the kings and the princes of Europe to set aside a new institution, to set up a new institution of forced schooling. And in that forced schooling, the dangerously irrational people would become so confused about what reality was that they would be neutralized.
Oh, let's come back on that note, John Gatto. That's a great word as well to describe what we're talking about, neutralization, pacification, or whatever. By golly, I don't know how valid their fears were, but their methods, their means and methods of dealing with that eventuality, the eventuality of active minds all through the populace, the means have been very effective. All right. We'll take a little break here. John Gatto can get a sip of water. You can, too. You can also pick up the phone and let your friends and relatives, anywhere there's an internet connection, know that the one and only John Taylor Gatto is with us for 2 hours today. Okay, right back at you at 12:22 p.m. John, so this confusion thing, I mean, that's, I've always thought of it as more, you know, that the public school would be a conduit for certain kinds of indoctrination and right thinking and what have you.
Oh, that but, too, and that, but, that, yes.
But your research indicates that way, way back, the idea of this, of confusion, of chaos, serves the purpose even better, maybe, and other people pick that up after Baruch, or should we say...
Both can work simultaneously. Obviously, school is a conditioning mechanism to condition certain habits, certain attitudes, is matchless. 12 years of being locked up and being rewarded or punished on a minute-by-minute basis. It would be amazing if you didn't condition certain attitudes and habits. But the confusion part is what jumped out at me when I was reading Spinoza, because it was exactly what the creator of the world's first successful compulsion schooling wrote too. That was in Germany, in North Germany, in the German state of Prussia. The head of the philosophy department at the University of Berlin, a fellow named Johann Fichte, F-I-C-H-T-E, wrote 12 famous essays to the Prussian king, and he published them so that they were widely known. He demanded that the Prussian king bring about forced schooling, specifically because Prussia's biggest cash crop was renting soldiers to other countries and making war on other countries. And if the soldiers weren't perfectly obedient, you know, the battles went askew somehow, and a huge catastrophe had happened to Prussia in 1806 when Napoleon invaded and just wiped out the Prussian army. The Prussians came to the conclusion that was because the sergeants and the corporals thought for themselves, and they wanted to make sure that would never happen again. So what we got was forced schooling in Prussia. It had been attempted for several thousand years without any success at all. You can set it up. You can take the horse to water, but you can't make him drink. It's such an absolutely crazy idea to lock children away with total strangers in cells for all of their natural youth. So people could always think of more sensible uses for the time of the young, until Prussia pulled the game off, and by 1820, it was up and running. Horace Mann went over to study Prussia, and delegations came from as far away as Japan to see this miracle that you could turn people into flesh and blood machinery. Human resources was the term used. Is that familiar to you?
You bet.
Okay. So here this conversion machine creating human resources spread very quickly all over the planet among the aggressively ambitious nations. They wanted to convert their population into human resources too, and the United States was right up there at the trough.
Well, in Germany you had a... sort of an authoritarian culture, sort of. You had a very authoritarian culture to begin with. All those Central European states, in fact. I can remember the account of, you know, the Hessians were dreaded in the United States when it was found that they would be coming over as mercenaries, some 17,000-18,000 in the beginning alone in our War of Independence. And even the German immigrants dreaded the men from Hesse. So they were the perfect laboratory, I would think. And I've got to throw in, I just recall a soldier from the Continental Army, our army, the forerunner of the United States Army, who was captured, and the Hessian soldiers that kept him, he later wrote, kept him captive, chided him for not being loyal to his prince. So, anyway, a little, just a little side note.
Yeah, Well, ultimately, 48% of the troops on both sides, British and American, were in fact from these little German states. They were known generically as Hessians, but a big chunk of them were Prussians. Washington's aide-de-camp, the bayonet guy, was a Prussian. His name slips my...
And mine as well. They named bridges after him. It'll come back to me. The guy who taught the United States Army how to drill, you're talking about.
Yeah, that's him.
Well,
so after Fichte had reinforced Spinoza's pronouncement about people in the main being defective, and therefore rather than being educated, they had to be tricked into lifelong obedience. And of course they were reaffirming what Plato said in the Republic. But then the ultimate killer came in the middle of the 19th century when Charles Darwin said the same thing. Now that's not the Darwin we hear about. But if anyone doubts that Darwin agreed with Spinoza and Fichte, they need to pick up Descent of Man, which was published in the United States in 1871. And Darwin said the vast majority of people are biologically inferior. He especially took off after the Irish, but he had a long list. I imagine there's some Irish listeners here. And he said, if you allow these semi-bestial creatures to breed with the good stuff, you know, the Scandinavian blondes, then evolution will march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. Instantly, that issued a license to people who like to fool the public anyway, that now they were doing a holy mission. Mm-hmm. They were keeping the biologically defective from interfering with the plans of the biologically advanced. That chapter has been wonderfully removed from school history books and science books, but it's as simple as going to the library. I guarantee you that every library in Utah will have a copy of Descent of Man. Just reading it, the prose is very, very clear. You know, just
Now, John, you and I have been through this sketch that you do and it's a very efficient presentation that you give. And I know there's a couple of more parts that as we get into the implementation phase, being financed by J.P. Morgan and what have you, I don't want to dissuade you from that logical progression, because I know you've also created an appetite in our audience for that. So, if we get a little bit distracted, feel free to get back on that thread. But I've just got to ask you, and maybe it's because I have early onset Alzheimer's, or at least that's my excuse. Right at this moment, I've got to ask you, I have seen school teachers get to this part of the presentation or a little bit later of this thumbnail that you can give so efficiently. I've actually seen them burst into tears having realized what they have been the perpetuators of. I've seen others get militantly opposed and dismissive of it. But I don't think I've ever asked you personally, as it dawned on you what you had been involved with, as humane as a teacher as you were and conscientious, there must have been a terrible sinking feeling that came over you in phases as this awakening happened during your research.
Well, I'd grown up in an intensely Scotch-Irish part of the United States, western Pennsylvania, and even though representations of all the European peoples were there, it was this fierce independence of the Scotch-Irish that gave the stamp to the area around Pittsburgh in western Pennsylvania. So I had breathed in the rebellious air as a little boy growing up. And when I got to New York City, where it didn't exist at all, where being standardized was the name of the game, I resisted that without any intellectual set of principles. Simply, my habit had been to operate differently than the New York schools were. I mean, we were reading in sixth grade in a coal mining town Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, and we were reading Julius Caesar, believe it or not, in Latin in ninth grade, the Gallic Wars. You had a choice. You could read it in translation or in Latin. But a number of coal miners' sons read it in Latin. It wasn't very hard. So I had this standard of sort of fierce libertarian independence. When I came to New York, I resisted it automatically, really. And I quickly learned that if I were going to be successful, I would have to conceal what I was doing. So I took on the character of a saboteur and succeeded very greatly in releasing, let me say, the genius that's locked up in ordinary people. That's why I won all the awards. People would think I had a set of tricks, and basically it was getting out of the way and giving kids something serious to do, or having them assign themselves something serious to do, and they would do such accomplished productions of whatever it was that the credit would be given to me. No one would assume that a teenager could educate himself or herself. And, of course, that's the only way it can happen. There are many ironies. So through the 30 years I spent in the classroom, I had a curiosity where this, what seemed to me to be, irrational system had come from. And when I finally left teaching after 30 years, I said, well, I'll spend a few weeks, it's turned into about 18 years now, trying to find out where this system came from. And the deeper I got into it, Dale, the more fascinated I was by the principle that everything we know about schooling is wrong. It is not education. It is not meant to be education. I mean, there's a distant cousinage between the two things. One is habit training and attitude training. The other one is being able to write your own script through your life. I mean, there isn't a school in the country that could stay open if it spent too much time showing kids they could write their own script.
So you never had an epiphany and then a conversion. You came out of that hard scrabble environment on was the Allegheny River you grew up on, as I recall.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a tough. You had Italian immigrants and, like you say, the Scots Irish, very similar environment.
In Middle Europe, Hungarians and Poles, and there was a, I would say, an extreme respect among those groups because the reaction to being insulted was immediate, fierce, violent reaction. As a consequence, people that I grew up around had this politeness to one another because they didn't want to be punched in the nose. I got to New York that boasted that it was a melting pot, and there was no melting place at all. So,
you know, you're just talking, John, though, but you're talking about a little nodule of old America. I mean, that was this country. People did have good, they had very fine manners. It's something I'm reminded of by watching the John Adams series is that
yes.
you know, you had to defend your honor and your word from in old America, because if your public reputation suffered, you were not viable economically anymore. You just could not insult people, because in that society, men could still, under the law, act as men and defend their reputation. I won't be insulted. I won't be laid a hand to. I won't be, what did John Wayne say? Okay, we'll be back. I'm very torn because now we got to let John tell the whole story here in a holistic fashion, get the beginning and the middle, the end. On the other hand, John, we are in the lunch hour right now in Salt Lake City, and there are folks just pining to get a question in on you.
Oh, sure. You know your audience, and I can go any direction you want.
Well, and for folks who want that, the rest of that story completed, and please stay with us, and it's also going to be archived. You can go to k-talk.com and scroll down to the bottom of the host page. Go to the host page and scroll all the way to the bottom. You'll find my ugly mug there. It looks a little bit like a redheaded Fred Gwynn because the picture is elongated. But anyway, you can go over to my website. You'll find this interview in its totality archived there probably later today. So I won't be laid a hand to. I won't be insulted. I wanted to go on that thread. But we've got Leroy, who's been waiting so long to speak with you. Let's bring him in on line two in Utah County. There's one Salt Lake line open, by the way. You can get on and grab that line at 254-5855, and I will get to you and give you a chance to speak with John Taylor Gatto. Leroy, a question or a comment?
I just wanted to say that I totally agree with everything he's been saying. I don't know the history behind how public school came to be, but you know, you just have to. It doesn't take long for you to look at what they teach and how they regiment it. That something's wrong with the system.
Well,
and,
yeah.
I got a chance to homeschool my kids for 3 or 4 years, and you know, I tried to teach them to think independently and to learn at their own pace and what they wanted to learn, and it was a wonderful experience. Just that alone, you know, made homeschooling a great thing.
Indeed, Leroy, I want to say thanks for your call. And John, this is one of the things that I wanted to ask you later in the interview as well, is just a sense of, you know, the atmospherics when you're in a room talking with I'm thinking of my producer's little girls, 8 and 11. They are a different type of human being than the public school kids of their same age that I know, the terribly burdened. Can you speak to that a little bit?
The burdening that you refer to, of course, as we've touched on a little bit so far, is intentional. They're supposed to be burdened. They're supposed to finish high school or college or even their PhD feeling somehow or other that they have to please someone who will then, quote, give them a job. The American ideal right through the Civil War was that you made your own work, or at least that was an option for everybody. Abraham Lincoln told the Wisconsin Agricultural Association in 1859 that we would never have a proletariat the way France had and England had and Germany had, because people set out to make their own work. And he said, and 75% of our population are either entrepreneurs, small farmers, seamstresses, traveling entertainers. 75% of our population has an independent livelihood. Well, this wasn't going to work for the big money accumulations that took place during and after the Civil War. You had to have people who would rather slavishly take themselves out of the sunshine every day and sit in a machine for 12 hours, 6 days a week. How are you going to convert a liberty-loving population into factory workers. Once again, we have stepping out of the shadows of history. The great names of the past, I mean the great financial tycoon names of the past, and they are the biggest effort behind institutionalizing schooling for perfectly reasonable motives according to their perspective on the world. They were all committed Darwinists. They all believed that these people were biologically inferior and had to be taken care of the way you'd take care of, you know, an idiot child or a pet or something. So it was a trade-off that Rockefeller and Carnegie, Astor, Harriman, there's a couple of dozen other names. They're the reason we got German institutional schooling. Rockefeller, in fact, brought the German teaching method into American universities. He backed the University of Chicago, which was some jerkwater little institute, and he brought in the German system. German system, for those of your listeners who are not up on that, means that students become raw material to be used by the professoriate to do research, write books. Rockefeller started put the money behind Johns Hopkins, which was the second bulwark of German university strategy. And then Rockefeller put the money behind Columbia Teachers College in order to get a German-type teacher seminary where the faculty could be trusted, not necessarily to agree with what was going on, but simply to be too sheepish, literally and figuratively, to contradict it. So that this German system of kindergarten, which after all is a German invention, to take children away from their parents so they won't become too tight in their family relationships, all the way through graduate university. It's a German system, start to finish, but it wasn't up until the Civil War ended the American argument. Argument between the South, the North, and to some extent the West was put to death by the Civil War. Once the South was out of action, the West had no ally to speak for it in Congress. And the German decades that followed the Civil War gave us universal forced schooling by 1910.
Well, John, I think about, with great pathos, yet another facet of the end of our revolution, the overturning of our revolution that you've just enunciated. Another way of looking at that, though, is that we took the values of the Enlightenment, which are, you know, antithetical to all of these values you're talking about the organized state, the authoritarian state, or the command economy and all the rest of it. Well, not a command economy, but essentially making all the citizens good fodder for the industrialists. But we resisted that. We resisted the banking system, their systems. Their systems of education and conditioning for 80 or 90 years. We ought to be congratulated. I mean, even though all of the old systems now have their sway. They're in full force now.
Yes.
We at least had 70, 80 years of Americanism, which is a body of history and evidence that they're trying to eradicate, but a lot of us still remember it. I think that's the value in your work, you've kept it alive.
The central leadership figure who represents that wonderful freedom that we once had is Andrew Jackson, who once he learned that Nicholas Biddle, who was the head of the central bank in the United States, was boasting that he could make or break anybody simply by extending or withholding credit. Jackson called Biddle in and he said, "You can break any American business, Nicholas, and I will break you." And he did. He broke the National Bank, that which shocked an awful lot of prosperous people. But it depended on the patronage of the federal government. And Jackson simply removed that patronage and put it out for bid. We could be doing that right now, Dale, with currency. Some people think Lincoln was shot because in the last year of the Civil War, he said, "We can't afford to pay this interest to bankers to create money. We'll create our own money." And he paid for the last year with greenbacks. The term's still with it, but a lot of people don't understand that it's simply debt-free money, interest-free money.
Mr. Ghetto, this is very interesting. It's very interesting that you'd bring up that Utah is the top of the modern education program. Brigham Young was opposed to it. You very eloquently stated. And in our Mormon religion, we even talk about this type of education when the educator teaches that which is against the parents' beliefs is called priestcraft. And when it's mandatory, it's called forced priestcraft in our scriptures. And you ask these educators what they teach, and they will say, "We don't teach education," and that is very true. They teach atheism. Is that not correct?
It is correct, although, in fairness, the lower-level personnel who seem to do the damage simply do what they're told to do. And there's a certain fraction of the teaching population who, to the best of their ability, sabotage the system. Not nearly enough, but everyone remembers a teacher or two who made a difference in their life. I mean, they simply do what they're told. So do the principals. So do the superintendents. It's set up to appear as if either the villains or the active people are at the bottom. But they take orders from somewhere. And if I could give you and Leroy, who called before, Tom, a gift. I've taken a long book which details the history of this, and I put it up absolutely free on my website. It's The Underground History of American Education. You can go to a bookstore and buy it for $35, or you can get it free on my website, which is www.johntaylorgatto.com. And I'd urge you to do that. If while you're on my website you feel like buying weapons of mass destruction, my wife will thank you.
Oh,
but you don't have to.
Indeed. Tom, you're a fantastic caller. I want to thank you. Normally I would have kept you on much longer, but we've got folks queued up, and then we'll have more people next hour. And if you didn't catch that website address or that URL, ladies and gentlemen, it would be www.johntaylorgatto.com. That's G-A-T-T-O .com. Just like it sounds, John Taylor Gatto with two T's. And we're going to talk about weapons of mass instruction, which I've got to believe is a sequel to the magnificent underground history of American education. But first, Fred in Salt Lake City. Thank you for your patience, Fred.
Oh, I appreciate getting on here. John, I have your book, by the way, and a couple of things. As a perfect segue, your past comments on how do you maintain control on what I call assembly line education. There's one disciple of Fichte that we need to talk about, and that's Wundt. And then you bring it to modern day. You've already talked about John Dewey, who came back from Fichte.
Spell that name you just mentioned.
I think it's V-U-N-D-T, Wundt.
Wundt, W-U-N-D-T, sure.
Yes, and then we bring it to how you maintain assembly line education control, and it's by behavior modification, stimulus response. Let's get it down to Sigmund Freud and the Skinnerian pigeons.
Well, you see, Fred, I cut John off at the knees before he was able to get into that, and I want to allow him, at the risk of mixing metaphors, to flesh that out next hour. Your question's welcome, but we're going to get into the Carnegie Rockefeller Ford Foundations and how this thing really, the rubber meets the road next hour. But go ahead.
Okay, there's just a couple other points, and then sure. I'll just jump off. You can respond how you wish. Mm-hmm. Anyway, those are you do it through behavior modification, through stimulus yeah. response, and I said Pavlov's dog. But now you get into the title monies with the Elementary Secondary Education Act of 1965 with all of the compliance strings attached to that you cannot be a sovereign, so you become a teacher rather than an educator. You don't educate, you teach. And if you don't, you lose the title money. So what we do is we become social change agents.
Okay, Fred,
I'll jump off, and I appreciate your thesis, John. I do have your book.
You're fantastic, Fred. Thanks. And we've got about a minute, John Gatto. You want to fire away at that, and I'll give you another shot at it after the top of the hour as well.
Sure. Your last reference, Fred, to the 1965 Education Act brings up another hidden resource of this schooling thing, and that is that it's a jobs project. It's far and away the largest jobs project in the United States. It's the largest giver of contracts, far bigger than the Defense Department, and it greens various people who play ball. Sometimes it enriches them if they sell textbooks or chalk or things like that. So the jobs project aspect was something the Prussians tried to force on the little states around Prussia. And
can you just comment on the public school? Is it not the greatest shaper of the society at large? When we walk out our door, are we not more than anything else encountering the product of that institution? It really is our culture, isn't it?
Oh, I think it's far and away the great conditioner, because it removes children from their reliable sources of wisdom in the family, the neighborhood, the culture, the religion, and it confines them away from the world with total strangers who are certified by the political state. I mean, I know that I've framed that in a creepy way, but it's a creepy idea. I think 200, 300, 400 years ago that it burned you at the stake for saying, I think we ought to drain all the children out of the community. The truth is that extending childhood synthetically, Dale, is one of the big purposes. If you look at American history, and I can tell you enjoy American history, we have George Washington, the official surveyor of Culpeper County, Virginia, at the age of 14. We have Admiral Farragut in charge of a warship at the age of 12. We have Benjamin Franklin having dropped out of school, been thrown out of school twice, actually, you know, actually undertaking on his own a curriculum of study, you know, at the age of 12 and 13 that you wouldn't find at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton today. And his friends are doing it, too. He's traveling on his own to Europe in his teen years, and this is a guy from, it's not a poor family, but it's certainly a working class family. The investiture of liberty in these founding names produced such a dynamic creation of value that it occurred to me to try to do that with modern-day teenagers, and it was, if I say it was the secret of my success, I don't mean one of the secrets, that was it. After about 60 days of the usual chaos, when the kids were absolutely certain that I understood that they could do virtually anything that an adult could do, and that I was willing to let them try, they completely changed their attitude toward schooling. We worked as a kind of team of associates rather than, you know, in the formal copy these notes off the board way.
Oh, that's a wonderful term, John, a team of associates. It's so spot on. Can you tell the story? Again, I'll interrupt our natural sequence here, but can you tell the story about the little girl? This is one of the first collisions you had. I believe you're a substitute teacher, long-term substitute perhaps, and you had a little girl who was in sort of a special ed or a subgroup for people who were learning impaired or whatever.
Yeah,
and
Milagros.
You know the one I'm talking about. Go ahead and tell that story if you would.
Sure. I was a substitute, and I had no intention of teaching. So it was something I was doing in between jobs as an advertising copywriter. But it was interesting. So I'm up in Spanish Harlem, and I'm given a remedial reading class. And before the class starts, this little girl, Milagros, comes up to me and says, "I don't belong in this class." And I said, you know, the way patronizing adults do, I said, no, this is all done scientifically for your own good. And she said, "I can read anything. This is third grade, mind you." And she said, "Just pick up any book off the teacher's desk." And I did. And she said, "Open it anywhere." And I opened it to a really tough story to read, although an interesting plot, The Devil and Daniel Webster, which is written in Victorian language. You know, 200-word-long sentences that run backwards. And Milagros read it flawlessly. So I said, "Well, we make mistakes from some time. Every once in a while, Milagros." I said, "Don't worry, you'll be moved. I'll speak to the principal." So I go to the principal, and I say, "Listen, there's a girl in this class who ought to be moved because she can read as well as I can." And the principal said, "Oh, Mr. Gatto," she said, these kids are so tricky. They will memorize a story and then pretend they're able to read it." Now, it only took me about a second to think of that. And if she could memorize The Devil and Daniel Webster. Anyway, the woman said she'd come in after school and show me, you know, what was up. So she comes in after, and Milagros can read anything. And the principal says, "You will be moved on Monday, Milagros." Then she turns to me in front of Milagros and said, "And you, Mr. Gatto, will never be hired again at this school." You know, I had done the unthinkable. I had challenged, I had crossed my, my pay scale.
Mm-hmm.
Something or other. Funny, in the book that's just out, Weapons of Mass Instruction, I tell a story that only happened a couple of years ago. I was invited to speak to a graduating senior class at one of the wealthiest public schools in New York State, at Highland High School in Hudson, New York, about 40 miles north of New York City, and the parking lot's full of Mercedes and Cadillacs. This is really a community with bucks. So I thought, how on earth can I do something for these kids in the hour or two that I've given? And I said, well, they will have been buffaloed, terrified about college admissions. So I'll just tell them some factual truths about college admissions. For example, that almost nobody in any position of power you ever heard of who went to Harvard, Yale, Princeton is higher than a C average. George Bush was a C student, but the guy he beat for the presidency, the guy from Massachusetts, was a C student too at Yale. And so were Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy. They were C students at Harvard, and they were C students in high school, too. The record is really formidable of how we've deceived the population into thinking that if you don't get a high standardized test score, if you don't get a college diploma, you're finished. Well, the entire computer business, from Steve Jobs to Bill Gates to Michael Dell, they don't have college degrees. Their partners don't have college degrees. Larry Ellison of Oracle, no college degree. The guy who runs the only international TV station worldwide we have, Ted Turner, no college degree. Furthermore, most of them said it's a waste of time. I'm not suggesting that all college attendance is a waste of time. I'm saying think about it. Think about it before you invest a couple of $100,000, usually borrowed money, you know, and are saddled with this huge debt until you're 50 years old. So I'm talking to the class this way, but in a nice, calm, even-handed way. I'm saying, don't be frightened. If you have anything real that you've accomplished, a good college would rather see evidence of that than a high SAT score. I knew that because I had had an interview with the admissions officers at Princeton and Harvard, and both of them essentially said the same thing. We're looking for people who have a chance to get rich later on or famous later on, and then they'll be benefactors to the college. So I said, well, what's the evidence that you go by? I said, is it SAT scores? And both of them snickered. You know, it's almost as if you have anything to show, if you've started a business or a little charity, or if you've achieved something in one of the arts, that's what they want to see. That's the dead giveaway, that you have a record of evidence before you got to a record of excellence. That was the Harvard lady's expression. And that's far preferred to high grades and test scores, because you get those by memorizing what you're told to memorize. In other words, I'll use a harsh term that doesn't always apply, but you're a flunky. You know, if you get high scores, it's a dead giveaway that you have punctually memorized what you were told to memorize. But that's not someone who's going to get famous or rich. So
there's a certain kind of performance on exams and ACTs,
yeah,
and what have you, that are indicative of a really institutionalized human, then they're not that interested in.
Dale, if you look at your own life, and I don't know you, or if anyone listening looks at their own life and counts up the number of times they thought the information on standardized test scores was decisive enough to ask their home builder or their barber what their SAT score was, the answer would be zero in every case. On some fundamental level, everyone knows the information is virtually worthless.
John, I'd like to get back, John Taylor Gatto, I'd like to get back to our thread.
When the break came, Dale,
yes,
I was talking about a lecture I gave, to graduating seniors at a very rich high school near New York City. But what I didn't tell you was the conclusion.
Yes.
I'm laying out the very mediocre standardized test scores and grade point averages of a great many famous people like Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy and George Bush and so on. And all of a sudden, the doors in the auditorium, they don't open, they burst open, and a squad of police enter the auditorium with megaphones. They say, return to your class immediately. Return immediately. This lecture is over. And one cop comes down to where I am up on the stage, and he said, this lecture's over. Leave the building immediately, he said. And I thought there was a fire or something.
Yeah, there was a fire. Well, an intellectual fire, right?
But can you imagine? You know, I tell the story in Weapons of Mass Destruction in the United States of America. That happened about 5 years ago.
You released a pathogen, John.
They couldn't deal with the truth, and nor was I delivering the truth as a harangue or anything other than a quietly measured, look, don't worry so much about, you know, taking the entrance exams. Don't worry so much.
Yes.
They didn't want that worry to be set aside.
John, I'm gonna circle back to this thing that I see coming, which is a collision between our now really manifestly authoritarian state that we live in, and the homeschooling concept and the concept of the free human spirit, the untrammeled or the unfettered human spirit that is really the subject of our discussion today. I want to circle back to that, but I have a caller who's waited all the way since last hour to get a question into you, and that might be a good opportunity for us to complete also the timeline in the wake of her comments or questions.
Yes.
The timeline where we sort of broke off we did intellectual history or the epistemological history of the ideas that our school system is based on. We didn't quite get to the implementation phase. Let's talk to Diane and say thank you for waiting so patiently, Diane, and a question or comment for John Taylor Gatto.
Yes, a very interesting program. Yes, I was just going to say Yale is infested with the Illuminati, which is to take down this country ever since the George Washington and them were trying to put it forth. The Illuminati, this group that Bush and Kerry all belong to, they take an oath to the devil, and they want to get rid of Christianity. We can see this all the way through your story and get rid of Christianity in our country. What else, what better place by the schools control the minds of the youth?
Okay,
and,
thanks.
I wanted to mention, too, you mentioned the Hessians. And Dr. John Coleman, he wrote some books on Rothschild, et cetera, different wonderful stuff he wrote. The Hessians were paid by English to fight against George Washington. And they had a pension fund that was for the wives and the children of those who were killed, the Hessians, mm-hmm. were killed yeah. doing this. Okay, that's how Rothschild got his start. He stole
yes.
the pension fund from the Hessians fund, and he got started Rothschild, and he loaned all of Europe. And then, of course, the Rockefellers, here we had President Clinton. He was a Rhodes Scholar, mm-hmm. and, of course, he was an illegitimate son of the Rockefeller, Winston.
Diane, thanks for your call. We'll try to tie in a little bit. Yes, the Rothschild banking concern, the sort of overarching family of all the central banking families, really got astride the world shortly after that period she's talking about in the Napoleonic Wars by selling or loaning to both sides and helping to perpetuate the war. And of course, it's really that banker money, that central banker money, I think, John, that is being that Ford Foundation, Carnegie, and Rockefeller Foundation are a conduit. Even today, it's the same gig, isn't it?
It is the same gig. But let me comment on Diane's statement that part of it was intended to get rid of Christianity. That's true, Diane, but let me give you an explanation why that's true. If you want people to be totally in allegiance to the political state and its leadership, what you have to do is destroy any other access to wisdom or any other body that you can appeal to. Religion essentially says that you can always appeal beyond the reach of earthly authorities to a supernatural authority. That can't be allowed to exist. The truth is, if this had been an Islamic country, they would have gotten rid of Islam. If this was a Jewish country, they'd have got rid of Judaism, a Buddhist country. They have to get rid of any basis of appeal beyond the political state, or they have to weaken it, if not get rid of it.
Yes, it truly is. The New World Order, or globalization, or consolidation of government under a global order, whatever you want to, whatever phrase suits you, it truly is atheistic. And this is the point, John, that I try to make on my radio program without infuriating people too much here in what is a very conservative, politically conservative area, that Islam, as alien as it may be to us culturally, the reason that so much military force, so much treasure is being spent to destroy or disrupt these Islamic countries is because, like it or not, they believe in God, and they are the New World Order chokes on them.
You're right on target, Dale. Let me compliment the Salt Lake area, or maybe the whole state of Utah. A few years ago, I did the keynote speech in Salt Lake City for the statewide homeschool convention.
Yes.
And I thought and thought and thought about this, and I decided to attack schooling on the grounds that it was a substitute religion, just as I think Tom said earlier, who called in the first half of the hour, and furthermore, that it sought to grant absolute absolution for the penalties of original sin in the Bible. And I went through each one of those penalties, like you have to work for your living. But in fact, what schools teach is if you're slick and you get a good job, you work less than other people. Maybe not at all, that you have to grow old and die. But certainly science seems to struggle toward eternal life and the end of disease and on and on. So the Salt Lake audience was with me all the way, and I really felt good about that, as if there was still a surviving enlightenment out there in the shadow of the mountains.
Well, John, I want to get back. You were in prime territory there. I missed that, and I could kick myself that it was on a day I had to work. But anyway, I had reports about your activities there and your speech and some of your then more personal interaction with folks. So they were very, very pleased with what you did there. But, John, I want to get back and complete. I keep threatening to do this. Let's do two things. Let's lay out three little goals here in our last half hour. We'll get to some calls. All lines are open. 254-5855. We'll get you on the air with John Taylor Gatto. Let's complete that timeline of implementation. It's very important, I think, to let folks know just how this thing was shoved down our throats as a nation, as a people. And then I want to talk about, we'll mention your new book, and I want to talk about what I see as the inevitable collision between this state, which cannot exist concurrently with a homeschooling culture, which is an American, really the American culture, the vestigial American culture. So those three things. Let's let Natalie take calls as they come in at 254-5855. And John, can you bring us, start us or restart us about the time that these industrialists, like Morgan, I know Morgan, it wasn't even his money, it was Rothschild money, but we'll go along with it and say
it was Carnegie, it was Rockefeller,
yes.
It was Morgan.
Yes.
It was Harriman, but the two key people are Rockefeller and Carnegie, because they start a private organization that spends more money on forced schooling than the government does by 1915. They call it the it slipped my mind, but it'll pop back
sure.
in. They make sure that foundation money is used to co-opt each aspect of the school business that we're familiar with. That foundation money, which after all doesn't have to be accounted for publicly, or at least the rules of accounting are much different than if a congressional bill sets money aside. And they set aside positions of privilege for school people at the end of their career. In fact, those two guys created the pension system for school people. But to get a pension, you had to rework your curriculum according to their structure. So the Carnegie credit system that everyone in the country must be used to, you know, you take so many credits of language, so many credits of science, call it the balanced diet outlook on schooling, you had to convert your school to that or otherwise you couldn't get this pension money. So in a fairly short time, every school in the country converted to the Carnegie credit system. And miraculously, I'm being sarcastic there, and I usually don't indulge in sarcasm, but miraculously, when the school converted and then said, well, how are we going to do this? Because school prior to that was really based on the personal expertise of individual teachers, and now you had this formula. Well, Rockefeller and Carnegie and the rest of them had official textbook companies that conformed to the formula, so that instead of thinking for yourself, you buy textbooks that conform, and now you're okay. Now you can have your pension. Now you can get free government money and free corporate money because you've pledged yourself to the new system, unknowingly, of course, the new German system, Germanic system that they were putting in. The two, way back in Luther's day, probably before, it was clearly understood that you couldn't get forced schooling on a universal basis unless you could control jobs and tie them to the amount of schooling you had. Not on performance, which is what sane people use for judgment, but on the amount of seat time you had in school. So you had to have that or you weren't going to get schooling.
John, you're describing the system, as I understand it right now, unaltered. I can't find anything different in what you're describing from the present day.
Oh, yeah. No, your listeners who are really curious, you can get a bit farther into this by reading my underground history, which, as I say, is available free on my website. That is, you got to read it there. You can also buy it on the website, but if you don't want to spend any money. So, but also, just by sitting back and saying, why is this done? And rather than saying it's stupid, say, who exactly does it benefit, for example, to have a $40 billion testing industry that uses testing instruments that don't measure anything? They cannot predict the future except in this area of obedience. There, if you're looking for people who are not boat rockers, you certainly want high test scoring people. Now, some high test scoring people are boat rockers, but at least you're part way to your goal of eliminating those people. This is a most sophisticated construction, and it's been building up. Really, it begins with Plato.
And it's just one of the saddest things that I can think of is talking to an adult who has been really successfully conditioned in this 12-year gauntlet, who has had his humanity pretty much removed, operationally removed at least, might be there sort of latent somewhere, but such that you can't talk to him about this. They can't even get a purchase on what we're talking about. And I've seen many of them. A lot of the most brutal people that I knew in public school, the folks who really embraced the environment of the public school, they went on to become local police officers. And then the folks who maybe weren't so rough and tough, but who really embraced the test-taking and all of the structured behavioral conditioning, they went on to become bureaucrats And I'll tell you what, the system of rewards is so vast and so complete now. It has put those of us who recognize something was wrong now fully recognize where it came from and want to be on the outside of it. We are also now excluded economically to a great extent. You know, what I'm driving at here, John Taylor Gatto, is that this system is so complete, so many certifications and offices and layers of bureaucracy. It can't let a healthy homeschooling a culture flourish, a competitive culture. It's got to eliminate it sooner or later, does it not?
You're right, Dale, but fortunately for us, it seems to be on its way to eliminating the beating heart of the American economy first. I don't need to tell you what trouble we're in now. Now, let me give you a statistic that isn't widely known. School set out following Spinoza, Fichte, Wundt, who we haven't talked about, and several others, to destroy the imagination. That's not my opinion. That is said in black and white, in any number of these leading figures. Why destroy the imagination? Because it's the one unpredictable characteristic that a leadership can't tolerate, because you may come from a direction the leadership hasn't anticipated and upset it. So it's been known for quite a long time from military practice that by regulation, by bells and lectures and a whole variety of other things, that you can, in fact, weaken the imagination or destroy it. Now comes the bite back. The United States, right up to the Second World War, had 90% of all the patents granted on planet Earth. This was the most inventive, ingenious country. We could always figure out a better way to do things, and so we became a dominant economy and a power in the world by our inventiveness. Following the Second World War, we get up to 1950, and suddenly the curve turns steeply downward. Now where we are, we have 28% of the world's patents, but the curve is still steeply downward. By eliminating all these people who could upset the apple cart, we have, I believe, upset our own apple cart. And nature itself is going to bring this thing certainly to a halt.
Nature's reset button. I thought you were going there, and I thought, well, you know, that is so sad, so sad. But that is our, you know, our only hope. But I've known that for a long time, John Gatto. Even before meeting you, I kind of understood that, subliminally at least, that this thing, the only way this bureaucratic culture we have is going to end is when it destroys itself through...
It is doing that right now.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the incidence of sabotage of the type that I said I represented is much greater now than when I left teaching in 1991. There's a skepticism about the value of the process and the product, as there should be. Look, there's 2.5 million homeschoolers in the country, and their first generation is having their own children. So there are a lot of skeptics who've earned the right to their skepticism. The greatest scientific project in the world today, the one that's at the top of the prestige heap, is the Human Genome Project, which is overseen by a homeschooler. I hope you guys all know that they're homeschooling and listening. Francis Collins was homeschooled on a remote sheep ranch in Western Virginia, using a system that he said publicly would have gotten his mother thrown in prison. Instead of the balanced diet, you know, 2 credits of English or whatever and 2 of science, Instead of the balanced diet, his mother's system was this. Francis had three brothers, all different ages. They had to study the same thing at the same time, but they decided what it would be, and they studied it exactly as long as it took to convince the other three that we ought to be doing something different. Mm-hmm. That's the system that produced the head of the Human Genome Project. Now, he has a partner who did go to public school. The guy had a failing average. He cut school all the time to go surfboarding out in California, but the school cobbled together a D average because they wanted to be rid of him. He was a horrible human being. His name's Craig Venter, and his story is told in an autobiography that can't be 100 days old. It's out. I'd urge you all to get it. So Francis Collins, the homeschooler, and Craig Venter, the school cutter, are the creators and the managers of the Human Genome Project. Well, what about a Harvard science degree or a PhD? No, I'm afraid not.
Well, let's try to... That's a great John Taylor, classic John Taylor Gatto story, and you'll find a lot of those in the books. We're going to make sure and talk about and mention weapons of mass instruction one more time before the end. But we've got another segment coming. In the meantime, I just want to get Arthur started because he's been waiting online in Salt Lake City as a caller. Arthur, question or comment for John Taylor Gatto?
Good afternoon.
Fire away.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Arthur.
Aren't you two just being a couple gallon gallstones?
You want to put a little finer point on that?
I was looking for my copy of the 5,000-year leap about a month ago, and I couldn't find it, but I did find Ayn Rand's Fountainhead. And in that book, there's a woman using this literary thing, the gallant gallstone, to prove that there's no such thing as free agency or free will. Anyway, so aren't you guys just being that gallant gallstone? I hope I am too. To just kind of free think and come to conclusions all your own.
John, you want to comment?
If you mean have other people been down this road before? Of course, I would imagine. Way back in Adam and Eve's day, someone would have figured out how official practice is skewed from what actually works. But it works for the elite and not for the commonality. So if you're saying we're echoing people you know, God bless you, Arthur, we probably are. But we've come to these points of view down different roads.
All right, there's our break coming up, John. You can get a sip of water and relax for a minute or so, and then we'll be back with the final segment, 5 or 6 minutes, with John Taylor Gatto. Stay right there. Okay, we want to reserve time to talk about weapons of mass destruction, and I'm sure you can learn about that on the website johntaylorgatto.com. But John Gatto, I want to get to one thing for sure before our time evaporates here. You know, this state that we live in has really, really transmogrified in the last 6 or 7 years, and now they're out in the open with things like total gun registration, compulsory national service, dreadful, obviously evil things. And I wonder what you think. Do you think that in its death throes, this big amoeba we're living in, this bureaucratic amoeba, this society, as it begins to die of arterial sclerosis or whatever, is there a chance it might want to deal Pol Pot style or Mao style with its internal enemies? Which
you and I are on the same page. The very proliferation of these obvious limitations on our freedom are a sign of weakness, not of strength. I think of the trilobites in the rock record of biological history. There were three or four types of trilobite for hundreds of millions of years. And right at the end, in the last few thousand years before they went extinct, suddenly there were thousands of different species. They exploded trying to find a way, you know, to continue. So what I see that's rather humorous, though it wouldn't be if I was a kid or a parent at this moment in my history, what I see is both the application of very, very stressful authoritarian measures coupled with the absolute abandonment of any standards at all. I mean, schools inside are much more chaotic than the public realizes. Half the time they only are quiet because the administration has cut deals with the hoodlum class. You know, you can do what you need to do as long as you're quiet when there are visitors in the building.
Mm-hmm.
I do think you are right on target. This is a sign of terminal weakness. Now, that's not going to help our kids and grandkids right now.
No.
But overall, I think we have room to be optimistic, at least, about this institution.
Well, John, you know, the gangs also run our prisons, but that's, you know, another whole thread. Of course, yeah. That's the second phase prison. You know, the subject of this program has been the first phase prison public school. But, John, we've only got a couple minutes left. We've got a couple callers who do not have internet connection asking how to get your books for a phone number that will help them get your books.
Sure. You can order the books directly from me at, here's my street address, 235 West 76th Street, that's a 7 and a 6, New York City, New York 10023, and here's a fax number, 212-721-6124. The weapons of mass destruction is $25. There'd be another $4.50 to mail it to you. If you actually want a copy of Underground History of American Education, which is a huge book, that's $35, and it's $5 for the mailing cost. But as I say, if you want to sit at your computer and read it, you can get it all off my website.
Well, John,
but
we've
not weapons.
John, yes, Weapons is a brand new book. We've only got about 50 seconds left. I've sort of mismanaged our last segment here, but can you come back sometime in the not too distant future and talk about Weapons?
Be my pleasure.
Yes,
to do that.
That would be great, John. Well, God bless. Would you take care of yourself, sir? You there is no substitute for you.
Well, God bless you. God bless the Valley and anybody listening. Just take a deep breath, folks. We have a fight ahead of us, but it's a good enemy to whip.
Indeed it is. And John Taylor Gatto, you have done devastation to our enemies. If you do nothing else in the course of your life, this body of written work you've created is absolutely viral, and it is a lethal virus to the abominable institution of the public school of compulsory education. This has been Dale Williams with you and John Taylor Gatto, our guest for the last 2 hours. Go to my website, folks, k-talk.com. We'll take you to the station's website. From there, you can link to mine.
AM 630 KTKK.